Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 157 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
There's something I want to say right now.
Really?
I do. I feel like we need like a theme, like a dun 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 dun, whatever that is. I didn't do it very well.
Can we leave themes to Bear?
Whatever that, well,
this is not
an Outlander theme. Not an Outlander theme.
Okay.
A theme for what we're about to start. Something as big as because they're small, as big and momentous as whatever that sound is, which I just tried to do, which I couldn't do very well, and we can't play it because of copyright, but whatever comes before dashing and daring, courageous and caring,
no,
faithful and friendly.
We're gummy bears.
Stories to share.
This is a gummy bears thing?
Just, no, my point is, before they start to singing, it's bum ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum. And that sounded a lot like Lone Ranger just now.
It did.
I want to play it, but I don't think we can play it. But oh my gosh, it's like dun 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 dun. Whatever. Okay,
Play like 5 seconds of it without getting dinged for copyright.
Okay, I'll see if I can find it.
Okay, well, we can post a link to it on YouTube so you can hear it yourself.
We will post a link to probably even just the screenshot or the embedded video. We'll embed it into our post for this episode. Whatever that is. You'll hear that little bump, ba-dump, and I've changed keys every time,
right?
I've done
it. And if it doesn't sound anything like that, that's okay too.
It may not, but
I really hope it doesn't.
All that to say, I feel like we need some like little intro, like musical intro besides our normal one. That's like this huge, big, exciting da-da-da-da kind of thing because we're about to start, girl.
You know what I think we just need? We'd need to do that too. I think we just need to find a free sound effect of a boat going.
But that's not authentic.
It's not.
That's like 20th century or maybe late 19th century.
Part of this book is in the 20th century.
Yeah, but not the boat part.
Oh, then a ding, 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 ding.
Or no, we just need like sea noises. Like, or like some. I like that though. We need some kind of seashore noises, like maybe waves.
We could be like the gulls in Finding Nemo.
This is the Outlander meditation. as the waves lap against the sea, and I just touch your finger, and that's all.
And there's wind,
or something. Yeah, like. Well, I guess we got it here. So what's this whole thing? What are we leading up to? What is this? What is this about?
This is about my favorite book of the series, finally.
Summer's been waiting more than a year to say that.
I've been waiting at least 2 years for that.
Neither of us said anything during Outlander, so I don't think the first year counts.
No, but once we started Outlander, we knew we were going to get here.
We hoped. But no one said anything until we started DIA, and I said, my favorite book! And you're like, I can't wait till next one is my favorite. So you've been waiting at least a year.
This should be very indicative of our two personalities. Ginger loves the book where they tear people apart. And Summer likes the book where they put people back together. So, and I don't really think that's a spoiler. We all know they have to get back together. So, and I'm also pretty sure that most of you have already read the book. So that's all I'm going to say.
That doesn't matter because we don't spoil.
No.
So before we get started, we've kind of just like teased. It's not a tease. We've been all over social media saying it's starting. Send us in your stuff, all of that. Before we get started, we kind of jumped the gun a tiny bit. Now, there may not be much to say, but we always try, when the show is not on, we try to have announcements. Because when the show's on, everything and everyone and their dog is posting announcements about everything. And rightly so. But we're not this news media outlet, blah, 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 to collect everything and to be able to curate everything. Is there anything in the last week or even recently, last few weeks, that we've seen or read or heard or anything on social media, in the news, whatever, that is big enough, important enough to say is an announcement?
I think the only thing that I've heard is that they're back in production.
You mean they're filming? They've been in production the whole time. It's just, but like a different part of production.
Correct.
You mean like the filming bit?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Sam's posted a few photos.
And I had thought that they weren't going to do that till September. So maybe they are getting an early start.
I think so.
Which is good because that means it's, you know, maybe a month earlier to back to us.
Honestly, don't hold your breath, people.
I never do. I'm not good at it.
I think that's the only thing I was even considering for...
I'll do better research for next week, I promise. But that's what I got right now.
So with that, let's kick it off.
Now, on to our read-along of my favorite book of the series. You're never going to... No, you will get tired of me hearing this. You will get tired of hearing me say that because I'm probably going to say it a lot. But now on to our read-along of Voyager. We begin, as we should begin, with the prologue.
That is true.
Which I didn't actually. Full disclosure, I just finished reading my chapters because I am a procrastinator. But I was reading through and I was like, I don't even think I'm through the prologue yet. And because I was still flipping and Ginger was like, it's only a page. And I was like, really? And I turned back and I was like, I had completely skipped the prologue. I didn't know that I'd missed it. So I had to go back and read it. But I did read it.
So before we get started, I just wanted to thank again everyone who participated by sending in their comments, their observations, their little nuggets, whatever. And as we said in the Facebook Live video, probably a few too many times on my part, this, granted, is only our third, and the first one you can't really look at because there was nothing before the first one. But you can compare it, I think, ish to Dragonfly and Amber read along. The response to just leading up, forget the fact that we've just are starting it now. I mean, response has been kind of crazy town, and we're very,
she's
maybe a little
people.
Bit amazed, not quite amazed. Like it shocks us. Not like that, but we're happily surprised. We hoped that you would be excited to start reading it with us, but this book, and part of it is Droughtlander and just, you know, something that people want to be a part of something during Droughtlander. I get it. So I know there's more than just, oh, I love the book, I want to be a part of it. But the response has been kind of crazy. And not just in contributions, but also in the conversation. People, you know, joining our Facebook group, which is at outlanderpod.com/group, by the way. If you haven't joined us, we'd love to have you there. But in our Facebook group, on our page, in the giveaway we just launched to help kick off the read-along, I mean, people like a giveaway, but this is kind of something else. People have a thing for Voyager, and I'm right there with you. It's not my favorite of the series like it is for Summer, but just a huge thank you to everyone. You guys have been amazing with your feedback and your excitement as we start this next project. The prologue of Voyager. We see Claire's been playing with portals since she was small.
Right?
Even as a child, she was practicing a superstition that it was, quote, only safe for her to jump or step into a puddle at twilight. And twilight and dawn are the between times. This is my language now. Just when the stars came out for her at twilight, she felt, quote, if I should fall into a puddle and on into space, if I could grab hold of a star as I passed and be safe, unquote. Now, she still, as an adult, half halts at her current age, which is the age at the end of DIA, so approximately 50, correct? Even at 50, this childish thing or fear or belief still haunts her, causes her to pause at the very least, though her feet do not. She thinks to herself, what if this time you fall? Now, isn't it interesting that at a young age, she thought or intuitively knew that there was something different about twilight? Now, twilight and dawn, as I said, are the two times of day, the two in-between times. She travels through the stones. Well, travel through the stones is made easier, at least, on the fire feasts. And she goes back in the books. She first fell through in Beltane, 1945, and came back a few weeks before Beltane, 1746. So let's just keep this in mind that we may not be able to make exact parallels, but it's interesting that child Claire was thinking about traveling to other places or other times or other whatever. And she was afraid of it. It was scary because it was unknown. So let's just keep this in mind. So Jean E. says of the prologue, the prologue of this book certainly sets up the theme of voyage and journey. Really isn't, quote, what if we fall, unquote, always in our minds as we navigate our own life's voyage? Joe B. writes, Puddles as reflection and opportunity. Claire, even as a child, looking for more than the ordinary. The benefits to being a grubby child before and perhaps again. It is a similar description of what happens in the passage of traveling through stones. What if? The question of the first section of the book. This time, what then? What next? You fall. Lose control. Faith. Hope.
No, oh, she said faith.
I know. Mwah. Lisa T. writes, this reminded me of a passage in Outlander after Jamie has saved Claire from the witch trial and she decides to stay with him. Claire says, quote, it takes thousands and thousands of years for the light of those stars to reach us. In fact, some of the stars we see may be dead now, but we won't know it because we still see the light, unquote. I think that Claire's reference to the star she could grab hold of and be safe is a reference to Jamie. He's not in her time, but she still sees his light, even distant as they are in time from each other. Also, she often refers to him as the sun, and what is the sun after all but a star? The puddle is an analogy for time travel and other worlds. Donna K. writes, you need to compare this with Outlander and DIA to put in context of what DG tries to do in a prologue. Outlander has an epigraph, while DIA and Voyager have prologues. Epigraphs are usually much shorter than prologues, and the Outlander epigraph is only a few short paragraphs. It simply implies that there will likely be an unexplained or unexplainable disappearance and that the person who vanishes eventually may or may not be found. While this clearly refers to Claire's time-traveling journey through the stones, it may also presage disappearances of other characters in DIA and Voyager. Galus and Roger's father, for example. The DIA prologue is a little longer than the Outlander epigraph, but not much. Still only a few paragraphs. However, it is much more allegorical in that the reader is asked to interpret three completely different dreams being experienced in succession by Claire, presumably. Awaking first in sorrow, then in joy, and finally in solitude. Sorrow and bone-deep loss from losing Jamie, fierce joy from remembering their sexual relationship, and finally alone, quote, beyond the touch of love or grief, unquote, back in the 20th century. This is probably after the death of Frank, but before she tells Brianna about the stones or finds Galus, quote, but no one knows the function or the purpose of the stones except me, unquote. And finally, the Voyager prologue is only slightly longer than that of DIA, still a few paragraphs. DG uses the symbol of puddles and childhood fears about falling through them into a bottomless sea or deep blue space to represent falling through the stones at Cré na Dun. Claire is remembering these fears because she is considering going back through the stones to find Jamie and fears that the journey will not take her where she needs to be, that this time it won't work. I had never thought of that before. I definitely got the stones connection, the passage connection, but I never thought of the, I think it was Lisa, whoever, the star. I can see that. I never thought of Jamie being a star, but I can see that. But I definitely didn't think about her being afraid in the prologue, being afraid of not working.
Well, when you think about it, because if they're not using, because you know, Galus had her whole little journal about using stones and blood and things like that to help direct herself to where she was trying to go.
Homegirl used stones and blood.
I know. My point is that's how she used her whatever to direct herself. And all that the other characters have seemed to use is thinking of where they want to be.
So even unknowingly.
Right. So that would be the star that would take her to where she needed to be, which would be Jamie, if she used it, if she thought of it. Well, now it would be Jamie. It clearly wasn't Jamie the first time. Well, it might have been a soul memory. I don't know.
That's the whole. See, that's the thing is none of us will know for sure until the end of the last book.
Come on, Diana.
No, take your time. I don't really. I want her to live forever. We'll get the book.
Well, I want Diana to live forever too, but I don't want this podcast to go on for 30 years.
Oh yeah, no, it won't. It won't. Eileen P. writes, I love that Claire as a child has this openness to the possibility of traveling to other worlds. While most children would have imaginary worlds in their minds, Claire thinks of the mode of transportation. I think that even as a child, she has a sense that she is a time traveler and that the means of transport is through nature. I wonder if at some point in the series, there will be time travel through a puddle.
Well, no, there could be. If the puddle is at the bottom, if it's like a lake or something and the stone, the circle is at the bottom
of
the lake.
That's true.
And remember the whole Loch Ness Monster?
I know. I know. That's true. But I wouldn't call that a puddle. No.
It's still water.
Symbolic of a puddle, then maybe. Or a puddle being symbolic of a lock, maybe.
And what if there's a little puddle at the bottom at the circle of stones? You don't know. It could happen.
That said, in Voyager, the prologue foreshadows the travel across the ocean to the New World. That's a little bit of a spoiler. There we go. In case you didn't know.
It's out there.
Ellen G. writes of Claire's speaking of puddles. It's almost like a scrying bowl. Another place and time.
Yep. I can see that. It's like and Roger in the bathtub all over again.
Oh, Lord. What did we call that episode? Rub-a-dub-dub?
I think we did.
One man like in that. The tub. I didn't add that
No,
part.
You didn't.
Roger did back in the tub. Martina P. writes, I am so curious to find out how other readers interpreted the prologue about the puddles. I was fascinated by it and only know the significance of it during dreams. It is said if you dream of stepping through puddles, it represents a parting or clearing away emotional troubles with good times to follow. What do you think about the prologue relating to the story? Well, we just read a whole bunch of people's ideas and thoughts, and people who didn't contribute, which is totally fine. Let us hear from you. What do you guys think about the prologue and what does it mean? We would love to have this to keep it safely contained, if you will, so as not to have spoilers. We would love to, as I always say, continue the conversation. We have a special event just for Voyager, anything and everything about Voyager, the book, in our Facebook group at outlanderpod.com/group. Come join us and answer these questions. We'll put up some prompts there too. What do you think is meant, represented by the puddles in the prologue? Okay, so now the prologue.
So that was the prologue. So now we are moving on to part one, entitled Battle and the Loves of Men, and chapter one, entitled The Corby's Feast. Corbies are also known as crows, I believe.
I thought it was possessive, yeah. So the crow's feast, not yeah. The crows are having a feast. Although if they had no apostrophe, it could be that. Yeah. Feast of crows. So the feast that the crows are having.
Yes.
And I had to say that because I'm a language nerd. Now, speaking of language nerd, when Summer was reading the part name and the chapter name, I had a flashback to something else. And something else you said at the end of Dragonfly. What are you happy not to deal with right now?
French.
Oh,
oh my God. French. So much French.
Okay, so chapter one. Jamie is on the battlefield, dead. Or so he thinks. He is weighing the evidence based on his observations and deciding whether he's in heaven or hell. He decides neither. Diana writes humor, especially in grim situations, very well. And he's not doing exactly one of Claire's taking inventory, taking stock, but he is doing his own version of it. Ellen G. writes, his nose hurts. And wasn't that where Claire kissed him after she got him out of Wentworth? It was the only place that didn't hurt. Joe B. writes, mostly dead is slightly alive, said Miracle Max in The Princess Bride. And this is how we find Jamie. Throughout this chapter, despite so much mental and physical pain, Jamie's dry humor continues.
Exactly. I love that the fact that even though he thinks he is dead, he's like...
having a conversation.
It's like, well, I'm waiting for these angels or anyone, whoever's supposed to come and take care of me in purgatory. He's like, I can't believe this must be hell because I'm sitting here. I mean, I don't know what
he's
taking.
Make it sound like he's waiting for the Valkyries or something.
You'd think he is. The way that
he does have
Viking
blood.
Exactly.
Who knows? So his ailments are cuts, gashes, bruises.
But mostly his nose.
He rebroke his fourth finger of his right hand. And then the name Claire shot through his heart. That's the language from the book. And I just thought of...
Shot through the heart and you're to blame.
You give Claire a bad name. Nope. I know it's love, but anyway. So the name Claire shot through his heart. And I will never not think about that song now. He's thinking again and again that he might be in purgatory based on the physical evidence and his spiritual anguish. Even as he lay in his purgatory, he prays for Claire.
But you would think that if he was feeling physical pain, that would be his first giveaway that maybe he wasn't dead.
Yeah, but he doesn't know what is in purgatory. He doesn't know that no one knows what you feel or don't feel. No, he definitely knew he wasn't in heaven. In heaven, you're not going to have pain. So according to his religious ology. So as he's laying in his purgatory, whether it's the purgatory or just his own hell on earth or whatever you want to call it, it's a euphemism, kind of. He prays for Claire. Lord, that she may be safe, she and the child. So remember, we are transported not just back to the 18th century with this here with Jamie, but to mere hours after Claire has gone back to the Stones. The despair is still fresh. The last time we visited the situation was at the end of DIA when, 20 years later, Claire and Brianna were visiting the manse in Inverness in 1968. Not 20 years after she went back. Not 20 years after the Stones, although it was for her. So by then, Claire had somewhat dealt with the idea of Jamie's death and had fully expected to never entertain the idea of seeing him again. With showing us Jamie right after the Battle of Culloden, we not only learn our hero survived, well, yeah, there are like 8 books, someone has to stay around, but we are thrown back 20 years into the story, forced to face the idea of Jamie newly alone, as well as Claire newly alone, those centuries away. And that we'll see more in flashbacks, right? We saw a little bit of in DIA.
But I think it's a good way to start the story because it puts you right back in that...
emotional.
Yeah. Because...
despair, absolutely.
Right. Because up until this point, we don't have any of that. Like...
she left you.
Yeah.
She dropped you off a cliff.
Right. So...
into blackness.
It's a great way to get us reinvested in the story. Because now this didn't happen for me, but I know it happened for some readers. There was probably a 5-year gap in between the last book and this book. So... you know, they have time to set the book down and they're waiting for the next book to come out. So they don't know what's going to happen. They just know that Claire says she needs to go back and she needs to know more. So that's the last thing, or however the last one ended. The point is we think he didn't die. That's mm-hmm. how it ended,
that's
right?
That's how it was Roger.
I don't think he died.
I don't think he did what he said he was going to do.
Exactly. So that's how it ended with, I don't think he died. So we're left with that feeling of hope, but we don't know what happened. So fast forward 5 years later, we get the new book and we're like, what happened? Well, the first thing we get is, you're right, he didn't die. So mm-hmm. it's the confirmation of the idea that we all had and were given by Diana at the end of book 2.
The hope that she gives you at the end of book 2
is fulfilled,
is slapped onto the page with blood and guts and everything into at the beginning of the book. Continuing his inventory, he finds his left leg is missing. He wasn't worried, though. He knew that he'd get it back in heaven or on Judgment Day. He stretched his hand down to feel for the leg. And he hit something hard. Quote, wet, snarled hair.
Yeah, we know what, I mean.
Some kind of hair. He reacted in an instant. The memories flooded back and he knew he was unfortunately not dead after all. So this is interesting. This will come back again and again and again and again and again and again in all the books. Or at least it'll be a topic of conversation we'll probably come back to again and again. Diana writes, or these are my words, but Diana writes, lets us know that memories are flooding back. What memories? He has some memories, but some he either has and doesn't share with Claire, or at least that Diana does not allow him to share with the reader. Or, as I understand, PTSD can be...
what? I thought I was going to sneeze. I didn't want to ruin it.
As I understand PTSB... TQPR?
PTSB, what would that be? Post-traumatic stress...
you bitch.
Bitch. I got post-traumatic stress, bitch!
I was going to take it out. Maybe we should leave that in. That's funny.
Oh my God.
Oh, okay.
So insensitive.
So as I understand, PTSD can be, you can have not just flashbacks, you can forget things and they can come up years later.
Yes.
Like details or flashes of insight or to occurrences that happened. So Jamie, obviously, just like he did with BJR at Wentworth, he definitely had PTSD, but I don't think he didn't. We learn pretty much from when he tells Claire at the end of book 1 and also in throughout book 2. We learn, I think, almost everything, if not most everything, from Wentworth. And even if there's something he's not sharing, he hasn't. I don't think he's lost those memories. I mean, whether he keeps them from her or keeps them from us is different. Whereas with Culloden, he remembers some stuff, but there's a whole heck of a lot that he does literally, legit does not remember. It's different than Wentworth as far as what he's able to recall.
It's because he probably went like full on berserker.
Oh, I hope we see that.
And then, you know.
Because his, dude, his woman is gone. His baby be gone. He has got nothing else to live for. His men are safe.
He does not intend to live.
That's
his
what I'm saying.
His intention is.
That's what I'm saying. Because if he did live, he would be, well, that's a whole other story. But.
Well, I mean, Claire painted a very dim and unappealing picture of the future if he lives.
Yeah. Oh, what would happen? Yeah.
Yeah. So he knows it's better through Claire what's going to be happening for the next umpteen years. Mm-hmm. The smart man doesn't want to be a part of it. The smart man wants to
especially if he was actually in the battle.
Yeah.
And he survives. You don't want to survive.
Absolutely.
Cindy P. writes, I love how Voyager opens with Jamie thinking he is dead and slowly realizing it was wishful thinking on his part. That someone who wanted to die so he could rejoin his love could make it through such a scene when so many died shows that miracles can happen. The body of BJR lay across him, head down on his abdomen. His quick movement jostled the body and turned it head up. Now, as he struggled on the cold, boggy ground, Jamie could hear the wind, the shouts and moans of others, and the wails, and the calling of the crows. And I just wrote, murders of crows. As he reached to cover his legs with his plaid, he saw that his left leg and kilt were blood-soaked, and he passes out again. So, I may not point it out each time, but Jamie has a number of times in this chapter where he comes to and then passes out. Comes to and passes out. It's a number of times, right? It's not just like once or twice. Angela in South Jersey writes, I believe that when Jamie was laying half dead on Culloden Field, drifting off and visualizing Claire, you see in the book where this is one of those break lines in the text. Then it says he was roused sometime later, hearing his name called and didn't want to wake because where he was better than here. I think in that break, his spirit traveled to see Claire in the window, and she's speaking of book one. And when he turned and Frank said he just disappeared or vanished, that was when his friends were calling his name on the field and roused him back. When he wakes, his spirit immediately comes back to where he is on the field.
That's an interesting theory. I think that we'll definitely have an answer to that at the close of the final book that Diana has promised us.
And should we spoil our interview with what Diana says about the ghost?
She said he was, what, 24?
25.
25. I was close.
But that's the age of him during Culloden.
That's true.
So all I'm saying is from the lips of the author, you can listen to our interview. That was episode 49. It's outlanderpod.com. It's very, we try and make it very easy for you guys to find things. outlanderpod.com/49 is episode 49. And you can listen to our interview with Diana Gabaldon from 2014, just after the release of Moby. That's mm-hmm. when we interviewed her. And we had a few random questions that were not Moby centric. And that was one of them.
Surprising.
Yeah. Very surprising.
Please, we had her ear for 45 minutes. We wanted to ask her everything we could think of.
Angela in South Jersey. Keep on to that, because I have heard that from so many people, and our interview with Diana did not confirm that,
but
did not deny it.
Exactly.
But it is evidence that might support it. That's all I'm going to say. In that, his age. So later on, he's wakened by someone calling his name. This is what Angela was talking about.
Though, there is also the theory that when people are dead, they go back to their
youthful prime.
Yes. So the way that he looks could just be his youthful prime, as opposed to a specific moment in his life, an active participant of that time period.
I would say Diana's confirmation of his age and the fact that he's kind of ish out of it, mm-hmm. out of body, out of, and talks about purgatory and talks about all these things and thinking about Claire, to me, that's a lot of evidence speaking for this theory.
Correct.
However, what is not supportive of the theory is not that he's not, and I can't say too much because we haven't learned of this yet. We'll learn it in further books, but not that he's not, it's hard for me to say this, not that he's not out of his body, not that his spirit or soul is not traveling. I'm not saying that, but I would offer that perhaps there are other possibilities to where or what he's doing other than standing, looking up at Claire in the window. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
That's all we have right now as far as sightings of Jamie. So that's all I can say. So later on, he's wakened by someone calling his name. It was near evening. Someone was saying how they'd seen him go down in that area. Jamie turns his head and sees a crow tuck into Randall's eyeball. Yummy.
And as I was reading this, I actually said this out loud, and I don't think that you would have known that this is what I was referring to, but I said, God, I hope they keep that.
Oh, I did hear that. Jamie is grossed out and lurches up. And he's seen four men help raise Jamie up and take him to the shelter of a farmhouse. Jamie wanted to tell them to leave him. He knew he would still die, but he was glad it wouldn't have to be alone. Eileen P. writes, I think it's interesting how little thought or emotion Jamie gives to the death of Blackjack. He can't remember the entire battle, including fighting BJR. But I would have thought there might have been some satisfaction that BJR was dead, as in, well, at least that's taken care of. I got to cross that off my bucket list. Joe B. writes, he also now knows Blackjack is dead, like Mother Hildegard showing Claire baby Faith, so she remembers rather than imagines. I wonder about the positing of BJR's death and wonder if we will ever see the full account of what happened, and leaving it unexplained is a true portrayal of some of the effects of trauma, but things tend to get revealed, and so we shall wait and see. Is it some small kindness to BJR that in death he is again so physically close to Jamie? BJR knows the date of his death, and I always thought he kind of believed Claire enough to at least be worried by her prediction. Or is it yet another irony of what will be his legacy? I can't help thinking that DG, in her capacity to find humanity in most of her characters, even the villains, gives this small consolation to BJR. Now, I always thought, regardless of what he knew or didn't believe, that, I mean, yeah, the placement's kind of like, but I always thought that, and we don't know, we still don't know, book eight, we still don't know. I always thought that maybe BJR was trying to protect Jamie in some way at the end. I mean, that's been out there. I'm not the only one to think that. A lot of people have thought that because he, like, you know, but the positioning. Otherwise, he was dying and crawled to lay over him? I don't know. What? You have a little funky smile on your face.
Well, because...
This is a little bit disturbing. What?
Well, the imagery of the whole thing, because when he finally sees BJR's head on his stomach and he was like, his head was moving grotesquely up and down on my stomach, I'm like, what would that look like? And then I was thinking to myself, it might give the impression of, like, I mean, I don't know which way his face is facing, but
oh.
With his head on his, practically his crotch, I'm like,
wow,
I'm not
summer.
Saying he was crawling to give him one last goodbye or anything like that, but I'm just saying. I don't know what happened. I feel like he was probably trying to kill Jamie himself.
Really?
Because I think that they were fated to die on that. Like, those two people, they were fated to kill each other at some point. Like, Jamie wanted to kill him because of what he did to him, and Blackjack wanted to kill Jamie because of what he did to Jamie. Like, it was like the fulfillment of the whole process that BJR had started. He never intended Jamie to live.
So Jamie is burning with fever. He thought of Murta, and he knew he was dead. He knew his godfather was dead, but he didn't know how or why he knew. The Highland army was defeated. It was flat out slaughtered. That is something else we still don't know, right? Book eight, we still don't know about Murta, how he died.
No, we don't.
So see, there's so much we can discover together.
So the fact that we don't know how Murta died.
But he is dead.
Could he have amnesia somewhere? And
he's dead on the field.
But have you seen him?
She does not show. Summer, stop trying to save Murta.
I want to save Murta.
I'm sorry.
I love him.
I love Murta in his place and in my place.
His place is on my screen.
I did not think you were going to say that.
It's there too, but his place is on the screen of my television. He belongs
for
there.
For seasons one and two. And maybe the beginning of three. Who knows?
All the seasons. I want it.
Here's something else that we should keep in mind for all the books going forward, and thus the Stars series. Quote, he had fought with armies before and knew such loss of memory was not uncommon in soldiers. He had seen it, though never before suffered it himself. He knew the memories would come back and hoped he would be dead before they did, unquote. So the reason I bring that up, that quote, is because Jamie recognized what was going on with himself. He had seen it in other people in his, probably during his time in France, early days before he met Claire. And it didn't necessarily freak him out. I'm sure he would have rather maybe known. Actually, no, he didn't want to know. He flat out said, I hope I'm dead before they come back. So another injury we find, his scalp was wounded from a bullet's graze. He's just racking him up. More descriptions of the Corbies, the crows. They are black, black as night themselves.
Have you ever seen a crow that wasn't?
No, this is just very
literary.
Black as night themselves, they had gone to roost with the darkness. But with the dawn, they were back. Birds of war, the Corbies, had come to feast on the flesh of the fallen, unquote.
You would think, though, being black birds, they would be more...
at home at night?
Yeah.
Some of the men in the farmhouse suggest escaping now, one last chance. But the English are, Diana writes, quote, thick as lice on the ground, unquote. No one will get away whole now. Jamie prays that his Lallybroch men started away early enough to escape the English, who would be on the hunt.
You said lice and my scalp itches. Like, you can't say that word without me, like, wanting to scratch every part of my body.
Jamie prays for Claire again, Lord, that she might be safe, she and the child. The men in the farmhouse smell burning. The government troops are burning the dead, and they hear the sound of gunshots. Just past noon the second day, the English, the government troops, came for them. It's so poignant, Diana's description of the men in the farmhouse. Quote, there had been no discussion of the possibility of armed resistance. They had no heart, and there was no point. The Jacobites simply sat, waiting the pleasure of their visitor, unquote. It was a major, Lord Melton, who came in a new crisp uniform. Lord Melton was in his early 30s, and he pulls out the orders of the Duke of Cumberland, quote, authorizing the immediate execution of any man found to have engaged in the treasonous rebellion just passed, unquote. Then he asks, is there any man here who claims innocence of treason, unquote. They find out they are to be shot. They have 1 hour to prepare themselves, and Melton offers them writing materials to write a last letter. Jamie felt grief for the others there, but not for himself. He had died when Claire had returned through the stones. He wondered if he would see Claire when he died, immediately, or, as he expected, to be separated for a time. He was just content to see her again. He trusted in this. God had given him to her. He would restore her to him. He lost himself in the memory of her face, her eyes, her shape. All sounds faded from him. So this might be another time where he's going away. Lord Melton returned mid-afternoon with soldiers to carry out the sentences. As each man is going to his death, he gives his name to a scribe for an official log of who had been executed. This is important. As Jamie's friend, Ewan, went out to be shot, he grasped his hand as hard as he could and said, I shall see you soon again. Can you imagine being with your friends, let alone family, as they are about to leave the earth, knowing or hoping that you'll be seeing them in just a few minutes? It's so odd. I can't even, like, wrap my brain around that. And then it was Jamie's turn. He said his name slowly. Now, Melton puts two and three together and is astounded that he's face to face with the Fraser of Brough Tuarach. He confirmed that he indeed was the Jacobite known as Red Jamie. Jamie was afraid to confirm this at first. He'd much rather be shot and end it quickly than be taken in as a traitor and executed in London, you know, Monsieur Fauret style. Yeah. But Lord Melton knows better, and he sees Jamie's scar above his collarbone. Then Melton ordered his men to take the rest, and he stays with Jamie. While Melton was muttering to himself, Jamie had time to observe his own thigh. Quote, the deep angry red of inflammation spread from mid-thigh upward, much brighter than the remaining smears of dried blood. The wound itself was purulent. He could smell the faint, sweet, foul odor of the discharge, unquote. Fun times.
You know, it's one of the few times, because we know that she likes to use many, at least three senses in each. Yeah. I'm really glad she didn't decide to use taste in this one.
That would have been disappointing. Melton asks Jamie if he knows the name of John William Gray from near Kerriarrick. And Scots, or people in the UK, if I got that wrong, forgive me. A fair-haired boy, about 16. He met him in the wood. Jamie saw something familiar in Melton's face. We learned that John William Gray, or the man who introduced him to Jamie, the young 16-year-old, as William Gray, is Melton's brother. Because Jamie had spared John William Gray's life, Melton was going to spare his. Now, he does struggle, however, with whether or not to let Jamie go or turn him in. He tells his lieutenant to find a small wagon and fill it with hay, and to find a discreet driver and have the wagon ready at dark. Jamie asks Melton where he's sending him. He replies, you're the Laird of Brough Tuarach, aren't you? Well, that's where I'm sending you, unquote. And that's actually the worst thing Jamie could hear. He did not, probably even worse than going to London and being executed there, he did not want to bring danger upon those he loved. He'd worked so hard to arrange for the safe return of his men and the safe passing of the estate into the hands of his younger namesake.
But I love the whole conflict that Lord Melton is having with himself. He's like, He's like, it's my duty to kill you. I should kill you. But if I do that, I'm dishonoring my family and my brother. And even though he deserved much worse than you gave him. And that's why it's the honor of my family. And I have to put that first. And he honestly, it's a much crueler fate for Jamie in the short term that, you know, and they're like, he's probably not going to make it all the way there because he's already.
But that doesn't matter because then your death won't be on my hands.
Exactly.
So who cares?
So he's like, I'm consigning you in your injured state to be in the back of a rickety wagon and have to ride down all of these. Because, I mean, it's not that close of a ride. It's probably, what, a week's journey?
I don't think a week. I think.
It's closer
at least
that.
A few days.
Okay. Well, at least a few days.
Well, I don't know. His Lallybrockmen went from there to there. So maybe a day or two.
Wow.
I don't know.
But they were on horseback, which has got to be much more comfortable than
I don't know.
Did bumping they have and bumping around. Well, they might have been walking. Because they
could. A lot
of
them did walk. Because they could. Exactly. Ellen G. writes, Jamie tries to get Melton to shoot him. While this is a sorrowful scene, it is hilarious in how DG writes the one-liners for Jamie. Melton is sending Jamie back to Lallybroch on a wagon filled with hay. Joe B. writes, yet again, it's Jamie's sense of honor that puts him in a situation not of his choosing. He did intend to die at Culloden, and so nearly gets his wish, as in death he believes he will find his way back to Claire. His act of contrition fades into a cataloging of Claire's face as his apparent last act of worship on the earth, and his last prayers are for her and the child. Or not. His mercy to young Lord John Grey is now begrudgingly repaid. Family honor is kept in perhaps a less than honorable way, but the purpose is served. The Grey family have discharged their debt, and Jamie is on his way home. Lisa T. writes, the chapter opens just as the Battle of Culloden is ending. As we know, it has been devastating for the Highlanders. Jamie is lying on the ground wounded, and thinks that he is dead and awaiting purgatory. Then he realizes, quote, this was hell, but James Fraser was unfortunately not dead, unquote. So begins Jamie's venture into purgatory. Throughout the chapter, there were allusions to hell, whether it is a physical hell, his fever, and the, quote, demons in his leg, unquote, an emotional one, where he has, quote, a terrible feeling about his godfather, unquote, Myrta, or his, quote, terrible longing for Claire, unquote. It is hell on earth. There is also the hell that he finds himself in when he smells the burning of the dead and later listens to all of his friends being shot. The hell of desperately wanting to die and the torture of being forced to live with the memory of so much loss and pain. Even the red coats won't kill him, but instead plan to send him home to Lallybroch. Quote, leaving Jamie Fraser quite alone and still alive, unquote. Leaving Jamie in limbo, denied entrance to both heaven and hell. Ava D. writes, Chapter 1 of Voyager is one of my favorite moments of the series. We finally experience the story from Jamie's perspective, straightforward, analytical, but full of passion and feeling. His voice is probably my favorite. DG does such a great job of giving us a character whose Catholic beliefs, among other beliefs in the old folk, etc., don't just influence how he thinks, they are his framework for understanding, and in this chapter, we experience his unique perspective for the first time. Jean E. writes, how significant is it that Jamie's first thought of a person is Claire and then his child? And one page later, the next human he comes across is BJR. Bam! Diana gives us all the important moments of Outlander and DIA. Donna Kay writes, this is the best opening chapter of all 8 books. We find out so many important things right off the bat. Culloden is over. We have to wait for Jamie to tell us, and that will be over the course of many books. Jamie is alive, but thinks he is dead and in purgatory. His memory is absent or confused. Jack Randall is dead in Jamie's lap, and Jamie can't remember why or how. Myrta is dead because Jamie just feels it, even though he can't remember what happened. Claire is gone. Jamie does remember that with great anguish. The cause is lost, and there is no possibility of escape. His fellow officers are doomed along with him. The English are shooting survivors and burning the bodies in great bonfires. Jamie wants to die, to be shot along with his friends. And Lord Melton is John Grey's brother, and only saving Jamie's life will satisfy the debt of honor owed him by the Grey family. Jamie is going home to Lallybroch.
And finally, Eileen P. writes, I keep thinking of fate and destiny in this chapter. Jamie and Claire struggled to change history, but Culloden happened anyway. While Claire's presence in Jamie's time must have affected history, perhaps it is all part of destiny and fate to do so. And Eileen, that is the biggest question of those damn forget-me-nots and the entire series. And we'll find out the last scene of the last book, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm sure. And that is chapter one of Voyager. We're moving on to chapter two, which brings us back to the present-ish, if you can call it present. Anyway, entitled The Hunt Begins.
Inverness, May 2nd, 1968. Okay, remember, we're in the books, which came first. The Star series brought up the beginning of Voyager a little bit into the end of season two, which makes sense. They needed a more visual, hopeful, dramatic ending than just words that Roger utters at the end of DIA. So with that, let's continue. Back at the manse, Claire is responding. Remember, book two did not end like season two. So that's why there's a little catch up to do now. Back at the manse, Claire is responding to Roger's line. And his line, if I'm not mistaken, was, I don't think he did what he meant to do, basically. I don't think he died.
That makes me think of The Princess Bride. I don't think that word means what do you think it means it does.
Claire is highly agitated. What he's suggesting is throwing her world upside down and topsy-turvy. 20 years of stability with her daughter, but 20 years without the love of her life. Jamie, alive, to even consider it would be too much to hope for. Roger insists that he doesn't believe Jamie died. He shows Claire the muster roll of the Master of Lovett's regiment. Brianna reads the names on the sheet. The last one, quote, James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser, captain, unquote. Her father. Claire rehashes this again. She knew he'd planned to go to Culloden. That was the plan once he left her, and they know he was able to successfully rescue his men. Roger continues, quote, from The Prince in the Heather. Following the battle, 18 wounded Jacobite officers took refuge in the farmhouse near the moor. Here they lay in pain, their wounds untended, for 2 days. At the end of that time, they were taken out and shot. One man, a Fraser of Master of Lovett's regiment, escaped the slaughter. The rest are buried at the edge of the domestic park, unquote. Roger goes through the historical evidence to discount Jamie being one of those shot. Young Simon wasn't one of them. He's well accounted for as a historical figure. And the man who survived wasn't any of the other officers, because there is evidence that they all did die at Culloden on the field. They are listed on a plaque in the church at Beaulieu. So by narrowing it down this way, it would appear that Jamie Fraser didn't die at the battle, nor was he shot afterwards. She may accept the fact that he didn't die on the day, but she reminds them that he is dead. 200 years have passed, so it's gone anyway.
That just kind of, it's kind of like defeatist talk, where she's like, okay, maybe he didn't die then, but he's still dead. That doesn't change then. And she's right to a degree, because she, even though time being what it is, and if time is running parallel, you know, as it has been with her passages through the stones, there's still no guarantee that at her time period where she is now, that he is still alive in his time period in that parallel. So I think she's trying to like mitigate her emotions to try to not get too invested on.
Not too excited, yeah.
Yeah, and so because he might still be dead. I mean, he is dead.
Brianna is still in the turmoil of having her life interrupted as well, finding out her father wasn't her real father, and that her real father was a Highlander from 200 years ago, and that he likely died a terrible death far from the wife and child he had sacrificed to save. Roger tries to comfort her. Diana writes, quote, even in his pity for her distress, thinking how marvelous she felt, all warm and soft and springy at once, unquote. And I wrote, is springy a euphemism for squishy, like boobs?
It could be.
I don't know. Is it like smelling like spring air? Because she didn't say was it smell or feel. She just said all springy.
It could be like spring as opposed to like springy. However, I would like to concur with their thoughts of a horrible death, because almost every death in that time period was horrible. For instance, George Washington.
Oh, yeah.
Great obviously father of our country, founding father, you know, first president of the United States, battlefield hero, all of these great things that he did. He had several opportunities to die in ways that you thought would have been appropriate and heroic. He died of a sore throat in his bed. Like he...
And it was painful.
Yeah. He like suffocated because he couldn't breathe. He suffocated from a sore throat in his bed. That is horrible. That's a horrible way to die. I mean, even that is kind of a mundane death for the time period. So the only kind way to die would have been like
in your sleep
at a ripe old age, which didn't happen very often.
What about Eliza? Did she die? She died when she was like 90 or 90.
She was 90 something.
Was she in her sleep though? I don't know how she died, but it wasn't violent. She wasn't like shot or anything.
No.
So it must have been in her sleep or of some.
I think she just died of old age. No one said otherwise. So I imagine she probably, I feel like she died in her bed. I read the book and I'll have to go back to the end.
So Ellen G. writes, Brianna is trying to comfort her mother. And then Roger, and I can totally see Richard in my mind, Ellen G. writes, going up to Brianna and putting his arms around her to comfort her. But where were Roger's thoughts at this time?
On her springiness.
Quote, even in his pity for her distress, thinking how marvelous she felt, all warm and soft and springy at once, unquote. Oy, Roger, finishes Ellen. That's what I was wondering. Is springy mean like soft and squishy? I don't know. Roger continues to push her. If he didn't die at Culloden, but Claire won't have any of it. It's too painful to think that the last 20 years may have been suffered alone with no reason, even though it was the best decision at the time. Roger, though, ever the historian, has a curiosity that won't stop. Had Claire been through enough? Dare he continue with his logic? He dared. Quote, if he didn't die at Culloden, then perhaps I can find out what did happen to him. Do you want me to try? Unquote. What a question.
It's loaded.
It is. Wow.
Because what do you do?
But without the question, we wouldn't have Voyager.
It's true.
Or anything else. Roger thought that Claire and Brianna had a right to know how Jamie's life had truly ended. Claire had not yet taken the thought of a Culloden surviving Jamie to the next logical step to face the journey through the stones again. And then he sees in Claire's face that she has the thought, the stones, again, and Jamie. Yes, she said in a whisper so soft he could barely hear her. Yes, find out for me. Please. Find out. That's all he needs. Jean E. writes chapters 1 and 2, comparing their first pages. Chapter 1, he was dead. This is Jamie thinking he's dead. Chapter 2, Claire says, of course he's dead. That's a funny little comparison.
Oh, that's
very
funny.
Good.
I didn't even see that.
No, me either. This is
why we need you
guys to continue to write in, because we do our best, but We're doing the entire book, and I'm doing I do deep rather than broad. So I need you guys to.
And I do.
Give us this stuff.
Quick and dirty. That's what I do.
I love, and Jean E. continues, I love this, and somehow imagine them thinking it at the same time in a wibbly wobbly, timey wimey way. That's excellent, Jean.
I feel like I need to post a picture of our
TARDIS.
Of our TARDIS to go along with that one.
Marianne C. writes, I've always thought of the first chapter of Voyager was about the resurrection of Jamie Fraser. He thinks he's dead, maybe in hell, maybe not. Then after 3 days of suffering, but believing he's going to die, he is given another chance at life, even though he doesn't want it. He has to do this without Claire. He has to be the one. There are no longer the two of them. The first two chapters make that clear. They are both alone in the world. Joe B. It is a great narrative tool to overload her. It's only in the recent refueling that Claire has spoken about Jamie so much and so freely and so long. To put on top of this that he actually may not have died is a bridge too far even for Claire. And as things are revealed, we see Roger and Brianna move toward each other, not in a deliberate way to exclude Claire, and this further sets up the connection between them. Also, I think it's significant here that Bree is the first person to begin to ask the question we have all had. Well, really, since page one. Although Claire's reaction is harsh, as Claire puts together that even if he survived Culloden and the aftermath in 1968, he's dead anyway, it's Bree who first vocalizes the big what if. It's a sign of Bree's acceptance of Claire's story and knowing that she has Jamie and Claire's genes and has been raised by Frank. She knows what she has just put out into the space. if he didn't die, dot, dot, dot.
I still want to know what Frank knew.
Good Lord. I will, yeah. Cindy P. writes, Claire's reaction to hearing Jamie lived is also interesting. It is also great to see Brianna actually support her mother here, when up to this point she had fought even the idea that Claire had been in the past. Claire...
She's her mother and her father's daughter.
Claire pointing out that, regardless, Jamie was dead, was also telling. I'm glad when she tells Roger to look, though. Donna K. writes, exciting start to a fabulous book. Jamie's despair and Claire's hope rushing toward each other 200 years apart as though fate had a hand, but does it? Donna Kay, I just got the chills on my back. Woo! Is it fate that will send her back to Jamie, or is it a completely independent decision on Claire's part? Stay tuned, boys and girls.
Or is it Brianna?
Or is it the plastic bag? I'm just kidding.
It's not the plastic bag.
I love that.
Spoiler alert, it's not the plastic bag.
And finally, Lisa T. writes, in chapter 2, The Hunt Begins, we meet Claire, who has just about served her time in limbo. Roger tells Claire that he believes that Jamie did survive Culloden. Claire rationalizes that whether or not Jamie died at Culloden, he certainly died. He's certainly dead in 1968. And yet, I'm reminded of the starlight from the prologue. The star may be gone, but we still see its light. Roger asks Claire if he should find out what did happen to Jamie. They both realize that if Jamie didn't die, that perhaps Claire could go back in time to him. And she agrees. Her time in limbo is about to come to an end.
Good Lord, y'all are way better at this than me.
Wow. So basically, like, if there was a parallel of a limbo / purgatory. Mm-hmm. And some, are you a little teary?
No, I'm just thinking that everyone that has written in this week is way more qualified to be on this podcast than I am.
Or me.
Like, seriously. I'm just like, if
someone's just like... He's alive. There were crows.
If there had been an audition process for my position on this show, I would not have made it. Clearly.
Oh my goodness. So you guys see how awesome the readers and listeners are?
I like the think tank. We need the think tank.
This is why we need you guys. So please continue to send in your submissions. We have the entire schedule up on our Facebook page, in our group at outlanderpod.com/group, and on Twitter and on Instagram. So you can find it anywhere. But if you email us, or if you DM us or contact us anywhere, we are happy to send it to you if you'd like it for yourself. And it's, you know, not easy to navigate those things. It's not a problem. Let us know. We'll share it. And it is projected all the way out till, I think, March. So, and it is always subject to change. But basically, other than this first little rush, our plan is to request comments by part. So we already kind of got into part one. Obviously, we're not doing it this time. But for the rest of part one, I believe it's one chunk. And then it's going to be all the chapters for part two, all the chapters for part three, all the way up through part eight. Now, some of them are longer, and some parts have a lot of chapters. However, the turnaround time is between like 3 weeks to a month. At your leisure, at your pleasure, and you don't have to do every single chapter. So don't worry about it. It's what you can and what you want to do. But do you see how fantastic these are? Things that we couldn't think about. And we love the way that you guys tie these in. So please.
And also, it's maybe not that we wouldn't think about it. It's just those are not things I would have ever verbalized. Like, even though it's something that I might have been like, I like that. I would have thought about it, but I would never, clearly I didn't put it down into anything or find a way to put it as succinctly as so many of our
definitely
listeners
not
did.
As succinctly. And I would have taken 5 minutes of rabble or rattling on whatever to get to my point.
Oh,
and
she also would have done 3 hours of backstory leading up to it.
just an hour and a half. So you guys, what a fantastic discussion for the prologue, chapter one and chapter two.
And that is this week's read-along, my friends. So please join us back for next week when we discuss Chapter 3, entitled Frank and the Full Disclosure.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our Audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.